Happy New Year, everyone. This is Pam Stack, your host, and you're listening to Authors on the Air. I am so happy to be here with you. It's kicking off the new year. Plus, this is Nasty Women January, our Female Crime Fiction Writers Month, and have I got a writer for you. Wait till you meet AJ Banner. Hang on, because she's coming right out. Welcome back. You're listening to Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I am so excited for this month because I get to talk to all the best women writers, as many as we could fit in anyway. Tonight we're kicking off Female Crime Fiction Writers Month with AJ Banner. Let me tell you a little bit about this woman she's absolutely magnificent. She was actually born in India but raised here in the United States. She wrote her first book at age 11. I love this because I remember doing this myself. It was called Mystery at Crane Corner. She drew her own art cover and bound the book with staples. So I remember doing that too. Tons of fun. She did a stint in law school. She had a job at a veterinary clinic. I know she loves animals because she rescues cats in her neighborhood, and I've seen their pictures. Her first novel of psychological suspense is called The Good Neighbor, and her newest release is called The Twilight Wife. It is my pleasure to welcome to the show AJ Banner. AJ, Happy New Year, and thank you for being my first guest in the new year.
Happy New Year to you as well. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. That sounds like a person with many professions. I appreciate you having me on the show.
But you have lots of different rich experiences to draw from when you're writing characters, don't you?
I do, actually. I've worked in a veterinary clinic, in law school. I met people who were interesting in a completely different way. Yes. And I'm not one of the authors that used to be an attorney, so I analyze stock trades as well. That was another one of my jobs.
Wow.
So I just have done many different things, but I always loved to write from the time I was really little, about 2 years old. I was writing with crayons, drawing little pictures.
I was reading your bio, you mentioned that you used to sneak books from your folks' bookshelves and kind of go under the cover with the flashlight and read. And you read everything from Nancy Drew to Tolkien, didn't you? As a fairly young person, too.
I did. I was lucky to have parents who were very well read. They had a huge library with many shelves of books in many different genres. And I have to admit that I did borrow some books that were well beyond my years. I remember reading The Eye of the Needle. That's Ken Follett,
yes.
I think.
Yes.
And I read that at about the age of 10. So I was reading in a wide variety of genres, and my father used to read to me. I remember seeing an article recently about how students do better in school if they were read to as children by their fathers. And I was read
really?
To by my father, yes. So he read all of the books, the Chronicles of Narnia, the entire Tolkien trilogy and The Hobbit.
Wow.
And we read the other C.S. Lewis books, Perelandra. He has a whole science fiction trilogy as well. I think Voyage to Venus, he read all those books to me.
Oh,
it was wonderful. I used to sit in this little armchair and be squished up against him, and he put his arm around me. And when we first started reading, before he knew I was reading over his shoulder, he'd be reading, and then I would correct him. I'd say, no, you missed a word here. You missed the at. You missed the. So he had to be very careful after that. But yes, it was wonderful. It was a very literary childhood. And I think the thing that helped me a lot as a child is that our television broke when I was about 8. So I really didn't watch television. I read all the time. I would sneak over to my friends' houses to watch TV. It was like this, you know, clandestine thing that I did. But I read a lot of books. Yeah.
So I want to wind back a little bit. You said you read Ken Follett's Eye of the Needle. Did you understand what you were reading, or did it matter to you, do you think?
I remember it was incredibly suspenseful. I probably understood about 75% of what I was reading, but clearly there were nuances, adult nuances, and things that happened in the book that went over my head.
Right.
But I hope I didn't turn out, you know, I don't think it hurt me in any way.
I don't think so either. So you've always been writing, but it took you a little while to get to the place where you wrote The Good Neighbor. So before we go into that, though, I want you to tell me a little bit about all the things you've done, because you mentioned some of your jobs. What did you take away from law school?
I graduated from Berkeley with degrees in anthropology and psychology, and I really was interested in those fields. Psychology is quite interesting to me. I think anthropology and psychology give you a broad world view. You learn about a lot of different fields. You learn about culture. You learn about the way the mind works. It's really interesting to me. When I graduated from Berkeley, I was still young. I think many students, when they get their bachelor's degrees, don't always know what they're going to do, especially if they're in the social sciences or the humanities. And a lot of people were going to law school. And I was interested in law to a degree. I think I was interested in helping people and trying to do some good in the world. And we all did. Coming from Berkeley, it was a time of great social change. It was a time when we were, you know, we were protesting on the steps of Sproul Plaza against apartheid, and it was a really exciting time, and I wanted to do some good. But, you know, I think underneath all of it, I am an artist. I'm a writer. I always had been. I'd taken an interest survey, one of those tests that we took where they ask you questions, do you prefer to be alone? Do you prefer to be with people? Do you prefer to, you know, work upside down, standing on your head or whatever? And I took one of those, those questionnaires, and the two, it said you should be a psychologist or a writer. So I didn't really pay attention to that. I studied psychology. I thought, okay, maybe I'll be a psychologist. So I went to law school for a little while, and I have to be honest, I was miserable. I was just miserable. I'd go to class every day and think, what am I doing here? And so one morning I woke up and looked in the mirror and I said, you know, you don't have to do this. You can do what you want to do. And I didn't at that point know exactly what that was. I'd left the writing from childhood and studied other things. And that's when I went back and worked for a veterinarian, and I thought, I love animals. Let me explore this. And that was a very interesting experience. So it was a period of exploration, and I slowly came back to the writing. I took the Writer's Digest School correspondence course. I started writing short stories, and I remember my first, and it was all done by mail back then. So I'd write a scene, and then I would send it to my teacher, and then she'd send back a letter. It was a typed single-spaced letter. And I remember the first lesson I had. I wrote a scene in which I had a character saying, she was really angry with her parents. She stomps into the house and yells at her parents. And I wrote, she was feeling very angry. So my first lesson was show, don't tell. Don't tell me the character's angry. Have her stomp up the steps and shut the door, and we will know she's angry. So that's how I learned how to write, and I started getting short stories published. And then eventually, there, you know, we had the internet, but I did everything by mail for quite a while, and had short stories published in literary journals, and it was incremental. You know, I slowly became good enough to be published.
The writing itself is incremental, as far as what you learn from your craft and everything else, isn't it?
It is. I think it's like any other profession. And in our country, I think, in a way, we don't recognize writing as a profession because we all learn to write from the time we're little. We write essays in class. We learn, or we used to learn,
sure,
cursive. Right. But in fact, writing fiction is a profession. It's a craft like anything else, and you have to practice. You have to practice every day. You get better. You learn different techniques. You try out different genres. You really have to do it for quite a while to get better at it. And I also think every book is, and other people have told me this, I don't have children, but people have said every book is like a different child. It has its own personality. And it just is what it is. Some are easier to write than others. So you're getting better, but at the same time, you might, say, write a couple of books and then find that the next book is far more difficult, even though you're a better writer. Like, it was more difficult to write The Twilight Wife than it was to write The Good Neighbor, because I had to put all the little plot developments, all the little changes in the right order. And that was difficult to do.
Uh-huh.
I had to rewrite it quite a few times.
Well, you're learning as you're going along. Hopefully, you learn something out of every work in progress, right? You're always refining your craft. You're figuring out new ways to write story, to write the dialogue and the narrative, and so on. So, when you're writing, I have been told this many, many times, and it's fascinating to me that some really spectacular authors that I've been honored to speak to have said that they always read their books out loud, or they read chapter to chapter, you know, so that they can actually hear, because it's a different sense than reading with just your eyes. You're reading you're reading out loud is a very different sense that you're enabling. So do you ever do that, AJ?
I don't read my books out loud. That's surprising.
Interesting.
I don't read them out loud, although for the one I'm writing now, I've been dictating scenes occasionally into my phone when I walk. There's a notes app, and I can turn on my little microphone and dictate the scene. And I've found that when I dictate a scene and then look at it and move it into my Word file, it reads differently. So
really,
it does. It's,
tell me,
it's
how
a,
better, worse. I mean, you say different. So, what does that mean to you? Describe what is happening.
I think that my speaking voice when I'm dictating a scene is less lyrical. My writing voice when the scene is coming from my brain through my fingers onto the keyboard or into a notebook, it tends to have more atmosphere and more texture. I don't know why that is.
Interesting. Well, because you're probably I would imagine it's because you're dictating a scene into your phone and you figure you're going to put the flowers and the icing and the bells and whistles once you get it into your book, under your fingers, in other words. Don't you think maybe that's it?
It could be. I think that when I'm dictating a scene, I just want to get through the scene. This is what happens. She goes to the house, she opens the door, she goes inside, you know, I'm just saying what happens.
Whereas
when I'm writing, I'm so
you're really painting the picture, whereas you're just doing the outline when you're dictating, maybe, huh? Some authors that I have interviewed have told me that they dictate their books. They use that speech to word, whatever it's called, you know, Dragon software and all, and that they really like it. A couple out of necessity because they were unable to, maybe from an injury or illness, unable to use their word processing capabilities on their computers. So, and they found that they wrote quite differently when they were actually dictating through that software. I wonder they felt there was a difference in it since you've mentioned that. It's interesting to me. Have you listened to your audiobook?
I listened to
the Good Neighbor.
I did love her narration. I have not yet listened to The Twilight Wife. I listened to the opening. I thought she did a wonderful job. She interpreted Kyra as a very thoughtful, she did a really good job of making her seem like a woman who has amnesia and is very confused, not knowing who she is. In fact, she did a better job, I think, than I did writing the book. So,
well, that's what I want to ask you about. Tell me the differences.
Between
tell me what you think the differences.
She dictates the story much more slowly. She has great inflection in her voice, sometimes a few different tones even in one word. And the character has that sort of sense of not knowing anything, not even knowing if the air around her is, you know, if she can trust the air. She doesn't trust her husband. She doesn't trust the people on the island. She doesn't trust herself. And that's one of the hallmarks of psychological fiction, I think, is that the main character really doesn't know herself. We don't know if she's reliable. We don't know if the world filtered through her senses is the world the way we're going to see it at the end of the book. And the narrator, Cassandra Campbell, does a marvelous job of depicting this really confused character. Yes.
I have not been one to listen to audiobooks simply because I would have to listen to them in the car or while I was doing something else in my home. And if I'm not concentrating completely on what I'm doing, like reading, then if I'm listening to something, it becomes ambient noise to me. It's background noise. So I'm always afraid that I'm going to miss the story because it's, like I say, it becomes just background sounds to me, or I get distracted when I'm driving. I'm not listening to what's on the radio unless it's a particularly good interview or something. I listen to NPR a lot. unless I'm concentrating on it, I don't. So, pardon me, but I know quite a few authors who've told me that the reason they started writing is because they listened to audiobooks and thought they could write a better story. And indeed, they wrote some really good stories. Isn't that interesting?
Oh, that's really interesting. It's fascinating. I don't listen to audiobooks either, although I have started listening more because I take long walks in the middle of the day. So if I write in the morning, I'll take a walk through the neighborhood, and it's a wonderful time to walk because everyone else is at work. And I can say, wow, I work at home, and I can be out in this quiet, beautiful place with forest all around me. And if I want to, I can listen to a book. And I'm able to concentrate because the only thing I'm doing is walking. So I can listen to a book, and I've listened to some that way, but that's not why I started writing. I mean, for me, writing was a compulsion. It was something I had to do from the time I was little. I just have no choice.
It just sounds like it. Well, yeah. You were surrounded by books and parents who read, and so naturally, and people who read to you, so that goes without saying. Do you have siblings by any chance? I just wonder if they're creative also.
I have a pretty interesting family. We adopted my sister from a Cree reservation in northern Manitoba when I was 4 years old. So I remember going on the train to get her from a place called the Paw, or it's Flin Flon. She was born in Flin Flon, Manitoba. So we're going up north onto the tundra to get this little girl. She was a year old. And then when I was about 17, my parents divorced. And later, my father and his second wife had a son, my brother Mateo. So I have a half brother who works for Polaroid in San Francisco. And my dad and his wife adopted two other girls from orphanages in India. So I have three adopted siblings and one half brother. Very interesting.
So, With the literary family that you have, is it nurture or nature? Are your siblings creative by any chance, even those that are adopted?
My brother is very creative. I know he's very creative. I think that my parents are both very creative. I think there's some nurture and some nature. But, you know, they came as immigrants to Canada many years ago, and they had to prove that they had something to offer the country. So my mother was a physicist, my father an engineer, and they stuck at that time. It was that you stick with the profession that you start with. I remember graduating from Berkeley and my dad saying to me, why don't you get a PhD in anthropology? Why don't you just follow through with what you started? And I could see his point. I just chose to branch off and try to become a writer. So I think my parents are both very creative people and multi-talented, but they chose professions in the sciences and the hard sciences.
Well, you're not kidding. That's amazing. To be around that much intellect as well as to have the passion for reading, too, is a wonderful thing. I'm jealous. Good for you. That's great. I have brothers who are – one who is an attorney, by the way, and one who is not, who does something with computers, don't ask me what, who's never read a book as a just for pleasure, has never read a book for pleasure. My other brother wishes he had more time, the one who's the attorney. But he's also he's very creative as far as his pursuits are cooking and wine. He's very, very good. Very good at that. So, and my mom was a reader. My father was not. So we all like the same kind of books, but it's funny. You're right. It's a little bit of everything, I suppose. I want to talk specifically about The Good Neighbor, your first book. Harper's Bazaar raved about this book. They said this could be the next Gone Girl. You are a phenomenal new voice in suspense fiction. And it will change the way you look at people closest to you. You have well over 7,000 reviews on your debut novel. Unheard of. Congratulations for such an outstanding, that's just in one location. I haven't even looked at Goodreads or the other sites where you get reviews. But congratulations on that. That's quite something else. It's very remarkable.
Oh, thank you.
How did Harper's Bazaar get a hold of your book?
Well, my publisher's Lake Union, and they have a great publicity department, and we worked with another company called BookSparks. They had another publicity company, and so they sent the book out to various media outlets, and that must be how they got it.
Amazing. It's just, and what a way to kick off your writing career. Congratulations. You were on an elevator and you're going to tell me about your book. Tell me about The Good Neighbor, please.
The Good Neighbor is about
a little bit about it. Yeah.
In an elevator. So I have a minute before you have to get out on floor 13.
There you go. You get it all the way to the bottom floor. Thank you, Tom.
I get it all the way to the bottom floor. It's about a woman. She's actually a children's book writer who nearly dies in a neighborhood fire that kills her neighbors. And she starts to believe the fire might have been meant for her. So the arsonist who set the fire might have been trying to kill her. And, of course, she wakes up in the hospital. She was hit in the head by a falling timber. She wakes up in the hospital after the fire that you know, raises her neighbor's house and kills them. And she and her husband move to a rental, and strange things begin to happen. And that's all I can say about it without a spoiler.
Very interesting. It's a fascinating book, by the way. As a matter of fact, I want to open up my phone lines because AJ is just so interesting. We're going to give away an audiobook, speaking of audiobooks. And so we'll give away The Good Neighbor to the first person who wants to call in and chat or has a question or just wants to say hello. The number, as always, is 347-633-9609. That's 347-633-9609. I love the premise for this because it gives me the willies when I can't remember things, and so amnesia and memory loss are fascinating to me. Fascinating, because how do you pinpoint that in a brain? You can't do a medical exam, can you, and say, here's what's wrong, we'll go in and fix it, right? So
right.
To me, those things are fascinating, and so I love the premise of this book. So not only did you just wow everybody with your first book, the next book, The Twilight Wife, is right now receiving so many great reviews that, as a matter of fact, you know, I'm looking at it. People love your writing. I see this all over my social media when we posted that you were coming on, and you're getting great reviews again on The Twilight Wife. So maybe we'll talk about that. Tell me a little bit about The Twilight Wife. We have a caller. Hold on, let's see who's calling. Hi, area code 740. You're live on the air. Who's this?
Hello. This is Laura Mo. This is Laura Mo.
Well, hi, Laura Mo. How are you?
Hi.
Say hi to AJ Banner.
Hi.
Hi.
I love
Laura
The Twilight Wife. Hi. And I would love to be able to listen to the Good Neighbor because it sounds really good. So.
Well, thank you.
Yeah,
well, we'll
I just
you get
finished
a copy of that. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I just finished it, and because I live in the Pacific Northwest, it, you know, there were a lot of images. You know, I could picture where she was writing about this, and this book. If you know, people who are fans of Gone Girl, this book is actually better to me than Gone Girl because I actually hated the ending of Gone Girl. This book, I think the ending is more, this ending makes more sense, if that
wow,
makes sense.
Wow, thanks.
Because
well, thank you.
I thought the ending of Gone Girl kind of cheesed out, whereas this one has a really good twist, and, you know, so it's interesting. You know, you talked about having majored in anthropology and psychology. It's like, you know, it's like, oh, she's talking about my life. I think what happens is a lot of writers maybe start off a little bit late because we have to try on a lot of different things in order to build up, I guess, get some knowledge that we can put into our own writing. Would you say that that's kind of helped inform your writing?
Oh, definitely. It's the life experience. And it's not that I wasn't writing all of those years. I was definitely writing. It's just that we mature, we acquire life experience, we just learn so much. I couldn't have written this book at the age of 20. You know, this is impossible.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you for
Thank
calling
you. I
in,
did
Laura.
Love...
You're gonna get an audiobook, okay?
Great. Thanks.
Thanks.
All right.
Congratulations.
Thanks a lot.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Alrighty, bye.
I loved Gone Girl. It was beautifully written. She's an amazing writer.
Well, it wasn't my favorite book, but I prefer The Good Neighbor to that book. I agree with Laura. You can call in. We're still going to give away another audiobook. The number is 347-633-9609. I want to read what was said about the next book called The Twilight Wife. So Publishers Weekly, who's notoriously tough on books, had this to say: a harrowing plot that reveals memory to be both unreliable and impossible to fully wash away. Kyra is a believable, empathetic protagonist, and Banner's ability to maintain tension while teasing out the truth of her hazy past will keep readers engaged. Congratulations for that review from PW, who, as I said, is notoriously tough. And, of course, Greg Olson raves about it. He said it's an enthralling, unforgettable novel that defies readers to stop turning the pages. And one of your friends, James Hankins, and I were talking about you the other day. I know he raved about this book. I hope James calls in if he's listening to this. Fresh Fiction, one of the best places to go and find out about books, was said it was breathtaking and suspenseful, unique and highly entertaining. New York Journal of Books, packed with mystery and suspense. The Final Destination is a total surprise. Well done. So congratulations on all the kudos you've gotten for this book. That is amazing. Let's talk about The Twilight Wife now and tell listeners a little bit about it, please.
It's about a woman who has lost 4 years of her memory, and I needed her to have lost 4 years and not all of her memory for a specific reason, but she was in a diving accident. She's a scuba diver and a marine biologist, so after she hits her head on a dive, she loses 4 years of her memory. Her husband takes her to an island in the San Juan Islands here in Washington State, beautiful islands, remote. It's a fictional island, but she's loved going there in the past to study marine life. So he brings her back to this place she loved to recover in his house overlooking the beach. And as she recovers small pieces of her memory, she begins to realize that her past is not what she thought it was, that she may not have been the good wife she thought she was, that her friends on the island may be hiding secrets. Her husband may be hiding secrets from her. So that's the premise of the book. And it was very interesting to do the research for it. I had to learn about marine biology, and that was really the most fascinating aspect of writing this book. For me, it was almost more interesting than learning about memory loss, because I did have to do some research on different types of memory loss and to try to determine what kind of what had happened to her and exactly what type of memory loss she had, whether it was anterograde amnesia or retrograde or a fugue state. I mean, I had to learn about all of these interesting aspects of her condition. So it was a fun book to write. It was difficult, but fascinating. Can I tell you a little bit about what I learned about marine biology?
Please. I'm fascinated by it, of course, because living in Florida, you know, it's a marine biologist's dream to be down here and being close to the Keys and everything. And where I live, there are a lot of wildlife habitats and, biology and so on, all these nature preserves and so on. So because we have a lot of barrier islands. So yes, I want to hear all about it. Please do. Tell me.
Well, the Northwest to me feels like the last frontier. I mean, there are so many unexplored islands here. I didn't realize that the San Juan Islands, some of them are uninhabited and disappear at high tide. So you have hundreds of islands here, and they're hideouts. You know, the Barefoot Bandit hid out on San Juan Island. That's where he was, and the writer who wrote about him was on San Juan Island. People take off in their canoes or their kayaks and disappear and never come back. And north of the San Juan Islands, we've got the Canadian Islands. So it just feels like this wild, unexplored place to me. So I made up an island there, and I had to learn about the things that would interest Kyra. So I read a book called Spirals in Time, The Secret Life and Curious Afterlife of Seashells, and I was just absolutely fascinated. Did you know that spiral seashells almost always coil to the right? So they almost always coil counterclockwise and open to the right. To me, that was fascinating. Why do they coil that way? It's chance.
Why is that?
They coil that way because they can't mate with a seashell that coils to the left. And so by chance, most of the population at this point in history coils to the right. There are certain small areas in the world, in Japan and at points in history, if you look at the fossil record, during which most shells coiled to the left. So it's not that it's more adaptive necessarily. It's just that if you have a shell that coils to the left and is trying to mate with another one that coils to the left, if there are fewer of them, they're probably going to have a hard time making it. So I just thought that was
quite
interesting.
It's fascinating that you're talking about shells because, you know, Sanibel Island and Captiva Island here in Florida are considered the shelling capitals of the world. So, and I'm very familiar with the type of shells you're talking about. Fascinating. You know, there are no coincidences as far as I'm concerned. Tell me what else you learned.
I learned that the hermit crabs line up to move into bigger shells. So they trade shells. They trade up as they grow, which I thought was quite funny. So people who have hermit crabs, if they don't know that, and their hermit crab is running around the house trying to figure out where it's going. Well, it's looking for a bigger shell, most likely. So I didn't know that. That was pretty interesting.
I spent enough time in my friend's pet store to see them when they leave one shell and go into another. It's interesting to see it, though. Yes.
Yeah.
What else did you find out? Tell me.
What did I find out about seashells, about marine life? Oh, this is interesting. At least it is to me. When you see a wave coming into shore, it looks like the water's moving towards shore, right? But in fact, the water's not moving. It's just churning in place. So it turns in place and the energy moves towards shore. But it's essentially a wind ripple along the top of the water. But as the waves come into shore, it's not the ocean moving in towards shore at all. It's just the movement of the water in a circle. So it moves in a circle, and then it moves across the water to the shore. But the water itself isn't moving. Does that make sense?
No, not at all, because I don't have that kind of a mind. But it's an interesting thing to hear.
I know. So I'm thinking, I can't put all this research into the book. I did a lot of research that didn't make it into the book because I'm sure readers' eyes would just glaze over if they knew that all this weird stuff interests me. But I put enough of it into the book to make Kyra seem believable as a marine biologist. She had to know enough, you know. She had to know what shells are made out of so that when she sees them on the windowsill in her bedroom, she's not thinking, oh, what a pretty shell. She's thinking they're made of, you know, calcium and carbon and all of these other things. She's thinking like a marine biologist.
How fun. Now, you mentioned that you were with Lake Union. I know them. I like your imprint. They're a really nice company, too. Have you written book number 3 already?
I have written a draft of book number 3. I don't want to say anything else about it.
That's okay.
I've written a
you
draft.
You don't have to. When would we expect, and we're going to take a call, when would we expect to see a new A.J. Banner book?
I hope it will be within the next year. So it will be next fall, I'm guessing. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's take a call from New York. Hi, you're live on the air. How are you? Happy New Year.
Hi, Pam and AJ. How are you? This is John Campbell in New York. How are you both?
Hi, John Campbell.
Hi.
John Campbell is a very well-known and very well-respected literary agent in New York and a dear friend of mine. Happy New Year, John.
To both of you. And congratulations, AJ, on the great success. This is lovely to hear. And you're marvelous on the radio. So bravo. That's like one step ahead already.
Thank you.
So listen, here come the questions about technique and style, if I might. When you're approaching a new novel, how do you approach characterization and plotting? Do you have the idea? I've asked Anne Rice this several times, and the answers are fascinating. Do you approach the plot first? Do you have a character in mind? Is there a tension or some kind of conflict that somehow you have to work out before you can start, you know, with the story or with who the characters are and so forth? Can you comment on those? That interests me.
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I would love to know what Anne Rice's answers are to those questions.
Like you just touched on research, and it was quite interesting what you said about research, especially the stuff about, you know, probably 90% of what you research doesn't make it to the printed page or the published page at any rate. And with Anne, I hope I'm not speaking out of school here, but Anne has often said that that she adores the research process, because not only does she into sort of, you know, first gear, so to speak, but she learns things that even if she doesn't use them in the book, she loves to learn. And so what you were just saying about the waves, I was laughing, Pam, because I thought the same thing. I thought, what the hell is this? I don't understand how these waves are not moving, but they're moving.
Exactly. Exactly. So, I'm trying to visualize it because John and I lived on South Beach. So, you know, we're used to looking out the window and seeing surfers and everything waiting for the waves to come in. And that's exactly what it is. So, you know, it's trying to connect the dots like that. Of course, John also has his doctorate. He's way smarter than I am. But let's get back to you and get those questions. Let's get those questions answered. Fascinating. How do you start off with character, with a story idea? Is it a what-if situation, AJ?
And by the way, just before, I should finish up with Anne Rice, who said, in terms of her plotting, she generally, and I think her son Chris is the same, she generally has the idea, more or less, of what the story is, but she does not have all the details, and she doesn't know where it's going, and she most certainly doesn't know how the characters will present themselves, and I'm sure this is true of most authors. But in your case, could you speak to that? It's actually not a two-part question. It's really one part.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's fascinating to hear Anne Rice's perspective. I think for me, there's a dialectic that happens. I think of a situation. So, for example, in The Twilight Wife, I knew what I wanted the twist to be at the end, but the original idea came from a completely different place. So, I originally wanted to write a book about a woman with prosopagnosia. about people who can't recognize faces. So I had the idea of a diving accident, and that she would have this diving accident and she would then not be able to recognize faces, and the people around her wouldn't be who she thought they were. But there was a huge problem with that, and that is she'd recognize mannerisms and voices and other things. So I had to eventually drop that, as much as prosopagnosia interested me as a concept. So then I thought, well, she needs to have lost her memory, and you know, many books have been written about memory loss. What would be interesting about this one? It would be set on an island in the Northwest, which, and the island becomes a character. So it developed from this original idea, but then I had to discard it. And then I wrote Into the Mist, essentially. I just wrote a draft. I didn't have an outline. The problem for me with outlines is they're so left-brained that I've become analytical in the writing. So I'll write a really general one. For the one I just wrote and for The Twilight Wife, it did have a very general outline, just a general, oh, this might happen, that might happen, here's the twist at the end. And then I had to rewrite it four or five times. The Good Neighbor, I rewrote several times. The Good Neighbor began as a book about time travel, believe it or not. Just was incredible. It
really?
Turned into a realistic book about a woman in a fire. Then I did the research on the fire, and other things came up from the research. And the research about fire was quite interesting to me as well. I spoke to a local fire chief who told me just fascinating stories about the fires he investigated. So I had to try really hard to keep all of those out of the book as well. So here's something for you. I didn't realize that in fires, not everything is destroyed. So people who, say, will set a fire to their shop thinking that everything will burn to the ground, they're wrong. There's always evidence. So, for example, a story he told me was about a guy who was losing his business, so he wanted to burn down his shop. Shop burns down, fire chief came in, took evidence, found objects with tags on them from the thrift shop, $2, $3. The shop owner had removed all of the expensive items from his store and put in thrift shop items, then burned down the store, and they were able to prove fraud that way because there was evidence left behind.
Wow.
And I thought, you know, that's so interesting to me, but I can't put that in the book. But it did suggest direction for me in terms of the plot. So as I said,
what about the characters?
The characters are more difficult for me. I don't think I start with character. I might start with the situation for the character, because generally my characters don't haven't differed too much from each other. In The Good Neighbor, it's a woman in jeopardy. She's an unreliable narrator. They're not too different. She might be a little more suspicious of people. I thought the protagonist in The Twilight Wife was a bit more, she was stronger, a stronger person. So I don't know. That's more of a subconscious thing for me, that the characterization. I'm not thinking or mapping out character.
Super answer.
Oh,
I'm going to sign off.
Probably...
I just wanted to say it's a great interview that you're running, Pam. AJ, terrific
Thank
answers.
You.
Thank you for answering my questions. It's fascinating to hear your take on both.
Well, thank you for calling
thank
in.
You,
I appreciate
thank you, John,
it.
For calling
so
in.
We'll certainly be in touch.
Thank you.
Thank
Bye.
You.
So then you consider your books to be storyline-driven versus character-driven. Would you say?
I think they're storyline-driven. They're not plot-driven. I think storyline meaning I have a character in a situation. So
yes.
Kyra's in a situation. She's lost her memory. And in The Good Neighbor, she hasn't lost her memory, but she's in this a situation, which is that she's lost her home.
Yes.
She's lost her home, and she may be in danger. And they're coping with these situations. And they cope with them in different ways.
Fascinating.
So, yeah.
I love how you come about your storytelling. And that's really, really important. I can't tell you how much I have enjoyed speaking to you today, AJ. I love that you are so into the research of it all. I know many, many authors who love the research and some who begrudgingly go to it. And others who say, you know, thank God for Google because that's all we have to do is just go on Google. But sometimes old-fashioned footwork is a really nice thing, too, when you get to speak in person like you did to the fire chief and so on. I love that you shared these stories. Thank you so much for that. Let's tell everyone where they can find you on the webs. And before we sign off, I think it's real important for everyone to know where to find you.
Well, my website is ajbanner.com, and I have links on the website to my Facebook pages and my Twitter account. And readers can also contact me on the contact page on my website.
Very good. And you answer your mail. I know you don't have an assistant doing it because that's how we got in touch with each other. Your name was suggested to me by more than one person when I said I wanted female crime fiction writers who had never been on the show, and yours was one of the first, I think it was the first name that was referred to me. So that says a lot about how well people like you and you like your work.
Oh.
Congratulations again. And thank you so much for kicking off Female Crime Fiction Writers Month with me and the new year. This has been really wonderful for me. And thank you. Will you
come
back?
Well, it's been wonderful for me. Oh, thank you for having me. I hope you'll have me back.
I will. I'd love to. And maybe you'll come on and let me ask you this before you go. Who do you like as a female crime fiction writer?
Who do I like to read?
Mm-hmm.
You mean which author? Oh, so many of them. I can't even tell you. I mean,
okay,
I'm reading.
Okay, so give me one of the women writers that you like.
One of the women writers. Well, I just read The Girl on the Train. I love many authors. Wendy Walker,
uh-huh.
Catherine McKenzie, Kate Moretti, of course, Mary Kubica. So many. I've been reading many, many books. I endorsed The Couple Next Door by Sherry Lupina. Really
uh-huh.
great book. That one's...
So maybe one day you'll come back and you'll be a guest host and you'll interview one of your favorite writers. How about that?
I'd love to do that. That would be really fun.
Okay. We have just a couple seconds left, and I want to know if you'll play Final Five with me. That's five quick questions and five quick answers.
Oh, okay. I'm
well,
ready.
It's also known as Stump the Author, but we'll see how well we do with you because you're really, really
author.
Smart. Okay. Yeah. what kind of music do you like listening to?
Eclectic. Eclectic taste.
Okay.
I love world music. I love classical. I like some kinds of rock and metal. I like all kinds of things.
Oh, that... cool. Whose book are you reading right now?
I just finished reading David Bell's next novel. It comes out in June of 2017. It's called Bring Her Home, and it is riveting. It really has narrative drive. I'm not kidding. It's a great book.
Oh, good.
Right.
Okay. I can't. I'm putting that one on my, you know, my list of 1,000.
I know. I have a list of 1,000.
What do you like to do when you're not writing?
What kind of hobbies do you do? Oh,
I knew you did walks.
I do walks. I hike. I actually play classical piano. I haven't played much of that recently, but I do play piano. I like to read. I like to watch movies, play with my cats. What else do I like to do?
How fun.
Draw. I like to draw.
Do you really? How wonderful. So you really are a true creative. You've touched a little bit on all the arts there and, you know, and the humanities and all. I think that's wonderful. Congratulations on that. So let me think. What else could I find out? I know. Do you have a go-to book that once a year you have to read it or not? Read it every single year regardless. It's just one of your all-time favorites that you've read more than once.
I don't go back and reread a book all the way through, but I love Stephen King's book on writing. I go back and read passages from that book. I love it.
Okay.
I love it.
You and everybody else. I mean, he is the writer's writer, isn't he? When was the first time you were comfortable enough to call yourself author versus writer?
When I was published.
So in other words, when someone asks you what you do, do you say I'm an author or do you say I'm a writer?
That's an interesting question. That's a really good question. I think I say I'm a writer. I think most writers say that. I don't know who says they're an author. Who says they're an author?
Isn't that
a
funny?
Good question. Mm-hmm.
There
it
you
is.
Go. Food for thought. Food for thought. AJ Banner, spectacular, suspenseful, psychological novels. Please go and get her books. And thank you again for being with me. I wish you all the success in the world, AJ, and you and I will be talking again soon, okay?
Thank you so much for having me. I love
You're
talking to you.
You're absolutely welcome. Thank you, and we'll talk
to you
again
soon.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night. So tomorrow, folks, I am going to be with two authors. At 3:00, I'm going to be with Ellie Alexander, whose Bake Shop Mysteries are just some of my favorite. They're delicious. Her new book launches tomorrow called Fudge and Jury. And then in the evening, the magnificent Terry Shames is going to be my guest with my special guest co-host Rob Brunet. So please join me then. Have a glorious evening. Happy New Year again. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.